In the 1997 movie, Liar Liar, some of you may remember that, Jim Carrey plays a fast-talking attorney by the name of Fletcher. Fletcher is a philandering go-getter who's only out for himself and his own self-interest. Having divorced his wife, he's emotionally abandoned his son. he's on the fast track, though, at his law firm, and he's, you know, to make top lawyer, and he's doing great in his career, but everything else in his life is falling apart. But and he'll do whatever it takes to get ahead, especially lie. He lies to his clients, he lies to other lawyers, he lies to his family. He's just a liar. Hence the title of the movie, Liar Liar. Now everyone knows that Fletcher's a liar. Even his own son knows it. One day, the teacher asks Fletcher's son what his dad does for a living, and he says, "Oh, my father, he's a liar." And she said, "Well, that can't be right. Your father's a liar? What does he do?" And he says, "Well, he wears a suit and he talks to a judge." And she said, "Oh, he's a lawyer." Some of you think there's no distinction. But anyway, Fletcher's son has learned not to trust anything that his father says. So one day he makes a birthday wish that magically comes true. As he blows out the candles of his birthday cake, he says, "I wish for just one day my dad could not tell a lie." And obviously, magically, through movie magic, it comes true, right? And so for an entire day, Fletcher is unable to tell a lie. When asked a question, instead of obfuscating or bending the truth or telling an outright bald-faced lie, he finds himself speaking the truth even though he doesn't want to. Even when, like, people don't ask him questions, he tells them what he thinks and what's on his mind. He's just completely out there, and it gets him, of course, turns his life upside down. In the end of the movie, Fletcher learns the valuable lesson, the importance of telling the truth and keeping his promises, learning to be a man of his word. The movie's funny, if a bit crass, so warning there. But it also gives a great insight and exposes how people in general, all of us, have actually, some parts of our lives have come to depend upon lying as a way of life. So this is not, we should not be looking at these Ten Commandments and saying, "Oh, look, yeah, well, I know that liar over there." This causes us to be self-examining as we look at these commandments. It's interesting, I just saw another recent movie with my wife, which, if you want to wait for it to come out, streaming, it's probably not worth it. It doesn't have a great endorsement, sorry, from me. The Fly Me to the Moon, it's in the theaters now. It explores the same idea, the importance of always telling the truth. It's about the conflict between the director of, it's fictional, it's completely fiction, it's like a romantic comedy, completely fictional, but it's kind of historically set at the Apollo 11 mission. And so the director of the Apollo 11 mission, he always tells the truth, but there's a conflict between him, who's always consistently a man of his word, and the public relations woman that they hire to kind of sell the mission and get the public involved and behind the Apollo 11 mission. And she's a PR person and salesperson. She just lies all the time. In fact, when you first meet her in the movie, she's pregnant and she's actually faking it. She pulls out her, just to get sympathy, from people. So that's her life. She just lies. And the movie's, it's okay, I guess, like I said. But the most interesting thing I think about it was the contrast between truth and fiction and actually the veneration in this Hollywood movie of a man who keeps his word and always tells the truth in that movie. Anyway, the thing that these two movies that I've mentioned, Liar, Liar, and Fly Me to the Moon, have in common is this idea that we all can become susceptible to what I call, you've probably heard it, the frog in the kettle syndrome when it comes to not telling the truth. And so much so that we forget that we're even doing it, whether it's kind of bending the truth or hiding our true feelings about something or, those little white lies, which is really just a made-up thing. There's no such thing as, a white lie. But or telling an outright lie, whatever we do, if we're not careful, deception of the sea can easily become a way of life. In fact, I think that's what it's like stands out in that movie. In some of these movies, if you run across someone who tells the truth, they stand out, don't they? As kind of radical, as being a man of character, a woman of character who always tells the truth. George Orwell once said, "In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. So today we're going to be looking at the ninth commandment that addresses the importance of telling the truth. So look there if you would in Exodus chapter 20. And as we come to this commandment, we're going to see that the world of universal, in a world of universal deceit, God desires that His people be revolutionary truth tellers. His disciples should be marked by character of truthfulness, men and women of their word. We're going to look at other passages from Scripture this morning as we delve into this, but we begin with our main text, which is just one verse, Exodus 20, verse 16. Hear the word of God. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. All right, so we're going to look at three things this morning. If you want, you can find this outline printed for you in the bulletin on the bottom of page 10. First, we're going to look at what it means to bear false witness. Second, we're going to look at what it means to bear true witness. And then third, we're going to consider an example of guilelessness from the New Testament. We'll define that and talk about what that means. A man that Jesus actually praised as a man of integrity and a man of faith. But we're going to begin here in the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, if you recall, one of the ways that we've talked about looking at the Ten Commandments and understanding them is to see them as a means of bestowing rights on other people. Right? So the first four commandments, we recognize God's right to be the only object of our worship, His right to be worshipped as He sees fit in the second commandment, His right to have His name honored in the third commandment, His right to have a day set apart for Him. Then we can also see the rights of human beings, those created in God's image in the Ten Commandments, the right of parents and persons in authority to be honored, the right to the preservation of life, the right to expect marital fidelity, the right to own property, and here, the right to a good name and reputation. After all, the Scriptures declare, right, Proverbs 22, a good name is more to be desired than great wealth. A good name is more to be desired than great wealth. Specifically, the ninth commandment has in mind here, in its specific application, the bearing witness in a court of law before a judge. If you think about it, in today's justice system, we rely heavily on forensic evidence, right? But before the days of CSI, right, it was mostly eyewitnesses who determined the guilt or innocence of someone being tried. And that's why the Scriptures make such a big deal about requiring at least two or three witnesses who provide corroborating testimony. In fact, it's interesting in the Scriptures and in the Old Covenant especially, when a person was found guilty of a crime of a capital offense, it was the witnesses who bore testimony against that person who were supposed to pick up, if it was a capital offense, to pick up the stones and throw them first. They were to leave the stoning, the witnesses who witnessed the crime. By the same token, if those witnesses were found to be lying and bearing testimony against somebody who was on trial for a capital offense, they would undergo the same punishment that the person they accused would have, and so they would be stoned. So if you bear false testimony against somebody in a capital offense and it's found out, you will be stoned. That's how it works. That's why it was so important to tell the truth. But this commandment is not just about committing perjury in a court of law. The ninth commandment forbids bearing false witness against your neighbor, but it also includes a much wider range of speech in our daily lives, things like slandering and gossiping. The New Testament talks a lot about the sin of gossip or slander, spreading false or untoward information about another person. And if you think about it, you analyze your life, you might notice that you might do this more than you think. We like to rationalize it, right? Sometimes people will say, well, I'm not really slandering or gossiping, I'm telling the truth. And if I'm telling the truth, that can't be slander, that can't be gossip. I've heard this, unfortunately, from even Christians who have tried to defend their slandering and gossiping tongues. And they say, well, as long as it's true, then there's nothing wrong or sinful about it. Well, there's at least two things to keep in mind with that regard. The first comes from Martin Luther. In his explanation of the Ten Commandments in the Lutheran Larger Catechism, he admonishes Christians to consider their official authority. What is their role when thinking about how you should speak? If you know someone is guilty of something, but you are not a judge in the church or in the state, Luther says, keep it to yourself. Or tell it to the appropriate judge, the one who ought to make that decision, you know, by witness bearing. He writes, if you do not trust yourself to stand before the proper authorities and to make answer, then hold your tongue. If you're not willing to go to those who are in authority in that issue, then you should not be spreading it or talking about it. But you should go to those in authority. Second, we can learn from Zacharias or Sinus. I don't know if you know who that is, but he's the primary author of the Heidelberg Catechism that we've been working through in our worship this year. And in his commentary on the Ninth Commandment, he wrote a commentary on the Heidelberg Catechism. And in that commentary, he writes about the virtue of taciturnity. I know it's probably a new word. It's a cool word. It's even fun to say. Try it. Taciturnity. Nobody wants to say it. Taciturnity. It's like taciturn. You just add it. Taciturnity. Anyway. Ursinus writes this. He says, taciturnity, or a discreet observance of silence, is a virtue which keeps to itself things not known and not necessary to be told, where, when, and in as far as it is proper to do so. At the same time, taciturnity avoids an immoderate use of the tongue in uttering such things as prudence would require not to be told. According to Ursinus, taciturnity is the virtue of silence, learning to hold your tongue. Or sometimes the scriptures, right, you'll see like when a person says that they're, or thinks that they're going to speak out of turn or something they shouldn't say, they will say, I put my hand over my mouth. Right? Job does this. Right? When he goes and God says, what's your defense? I put my hand over my mouth. I got nothing to say. Right? I don't have a defense. So here's what Luther says, Ursinus. He says, he who goes on to speak about how, or sorry, he goes on to speak about how if something is true, if it is secret, then it ought to be kept secret. Ursinus writes, taciturnity is such a profession of the truth as that which keeps to itself things that are secret, whether true or false, and which avoids conversation that is unnecessary and useless, especially that which is untimely, baneful, and calculated to give offense. If you've been in the Sunday school class, which we're on break now, but we'll be returning to the Westminster Larger Catechism in the fall, we've worked our way through the Ten Commandments. And one of the things that the Larger Catechism talks about when it talks about the sins forbidden in the Ninth Commandment is speaking the truth unseasonably. It's a good phrase and a good way to remember it. Speaking the truth unseasonably. Speaking out of turn or in a place where it ought not to be spoken. Now, of course, this does not mean, should make sure we have some caveats here, this does not mean that we should remain silent if we see a crime being committed or learn of some kind of abuse or heinous sin. Those should be confronted and dealt with by the proper authorities. Keeping the Ninth Commandment is not licensed to cover up sin. But what we're talking about here is speaking out of turn, speaking the truth unseasonably toward the end of harming someone when it doesn't need to be. Speaking about things that are none of our business, about those things that are unnecessarily, that defame a person's name and character. It's what the Bible speaks about in Proverbs 11:13. It says, he who goes about as a talebearer, right, bears tales, reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy conceals the matter. Now, of course, when we're thinking about these things, you have to apply wisdom and discernment to apply these principles in specific situations. Surely, I think everyone here probably knows someone who is trustworthy and taciturn. Someone with whom we can share a secret and know that they will keep it to themselves. In the words of George Costanza, they put it in the vault. No Seinfeld. Okay, anyway. On the flip side, though, I think each one of us probably knows someone else that we have to be careful and circumspect when we're talking to them because we know that they can't be trusted with it, right? And they're just going to be, as the proverb says, a talebearer. Or they may use it against you if you share too much, right? We know things like that. But think about this. The next time that you want to share something about a third party, somebody else, with someone that you know, consider this question: would I be comfortable saying what I'm about to say if that person that I'm talking about were present during this conversation? Or if someone else wants to gossip, interrupt them. I had this experience. There was a woman in the church I pastored in Macon, Georgia, where we lived years ago, and she was a gossip. And she could not be trusted with anything in the church, and she told everybody everything, and she was on staff. Anyway, so one day I remember coming to the office, and she said, "I'm not sure if I should tell you this or not." I said, "Stop. Go with your gut. If you're not sure that you should tell me this, then don't tell me this." Right? If it rises to such an occasion where you think it ought to come to me, then think about it, pray about it. But if your gut is telling you, "I'm not sure if I should tell you this," go with that. Right? We don't need to be speaking out of turn or unseasonably about things. But the sin of gossip is an ongoing problem. We deal with the day. The Apostle Paul dealt with it in his day. And we see how when Paul deals with the problem of gossip, interestingly, he seems to point to two root causes for it. Let me show you what I'm talking about. If you have your Bibles, turn to the New Testament, to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And I'll give you a minute to get there. 2 Timothy, this is Paul's final letter, at least the final one that we know of, that he wrote to his protege Timothy. Look what he says there in 2 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. He lists all these sins. That's what I want to show you. So look what he says. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. "But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come." Okay, maybe we should just need to clarify there, just FYI. When he says last days, he said already, we're in the last days. And Jesus ushered in the last days. So expect this. "But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power. Avoid such men as these." Okay, so notice in the middle of this text, of these lists of sins, he mentions malicious gossips. And from the context, we learn that one of the causes for the malice of gossiping is arrogance, to be a lover of oneself. It's arrogance and pride that makes us want to denigrate other people, to speak about them, and sort of maybe lower their esteem or their name in other people's eyes. Because what does that do to us? It raises us up, right, in their eyes. At least that's how we think. And so we have arrogance and wishing to promote ourselves. Turn back a page or two to 1 Timothy 5, if you would. In 1 Timothy 5, Paul gets very specific about, it's interesting here, how to treat and take care of widows in the church. Particularly the requirements for putting widows on a list that is kept by the church of widows who would receive help and benevolence. But Paul says something interesting here. He says, don't put young widows on that list. Who receive financial help from the church for two reasons. First, because young widows naturally desire to be married, to marry again. And the second reason comes in verse 13. So there in 1 Timothy 5:13, he says, "At the same time, they also learn to be idle, as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention." One of the reasons you see that Paul speaks about this issue with young widows ought not to be put on this benevolence list is because that might cause them to be idle, and from out of their idleness will spring this opportunity for what? For gossiping and being busybodies, talking about things that is not proper to mention. John Stott says they wind up wasting their time in frivolous talk. Wasting your time in frivolous talk. So, you see, arrogance and idleness seem to be these kind of two causes that kind of undergird this, the sin of gossiping. And that's extremely helpful if you think about it, how we can particularly keep the ninth commandment to not bear false witness. We need to be aware of an arrogance in our own heart and idleness in our lives. Because from arrogance and idleness comes forth gossiping, slander, character assassination. I mean, I've seen this also in context of just hanging out with people, right? And whether it be at work or in the army or whatever you're doing. And like there's silence, and somebody feels like they need to fill the silence, so they say something that would probably be, should not be said, right? That's unseemly or that's out of context. Because once that happens, gossip takes hold, leads to greater sins. A party spirit, taking sides in the church, divisiveness, and even worse, hatred and murder. All springing up because we did not keep in check our arrogance and our idleness. By the way, while I'm here in 1 Timothy 5, notice what Paul says about how believers ought to receive accusations against elders in the church. It's the same principle we saw earlier, and it's there in verse 19. 1 Timothy 5:19. Paul says, let me find here. Do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. That's the same standard that Jesus applies in Matthew 18, right? Where he teaches about how to deal with sin in the church, right? First, talk to that person individually, and then take two or three witnesses, he says, along with you. How much strife and dissension could the people of God or the people in your workplace avoid if we follow these simple steps? Keep your arrogance and idleness in check, lest the sin of gossip enter in and take hold. So instead of bearing false witness, God's people are to bear true witness. And that brings us to our second point this morning. It's the positive side of the ninth commandment. And as we've seen in previous commandments, it's actually something that Jesus addresses in the Sermon on the Mount. So, let me ask you to turn to Matthew chapter 5, the first book of the New Testament, Matthew chapter 5. And let me just remind you as we're turning there, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is establishing the law of God and peeling back the surface so that we can see not just the letter, but the spirit of it. He's opposing that legalistic and misguided interpretation of the scribes and Pharisees. And so he says, you know, you've been told that this is what the law means, such and such, but I'm telling you the real heart of the law, and this is what it means. So look what Jesus, the lawgiver, has to say about the ninth commandment. He actually doesn't quote the ninth commandment, but he talks about the importance of speech and of speaking truth and vows. Look at verse 33, Matthew 5, verse 33, where Jesus says, "Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.' But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil." If I had to describe Jesus' teaching in these verses, I would, in two words, be dependable. Be dependable. I mean, I'll add a few more words in your speech, but be dependable. You see, the problem that Jesus is dealing with here has to do with how the Pharisees had taken this law about keeping a vow, and they reduced it to only address that which actually takes place in the court of law. They're looking at the letter of the law. And so they rightly maintained that to take an oath or a vow in a court of law and then break it, it is bearing false witness. It's a sin. But their problem was that they limited it only to the court of law. And so outside of the court, according to the scribes and Pharisees, if you made a vow or swore an oath and then broke it, well, technically, that wasn't a violation of this commandment because you're not in a court. So you can go out and make a, you know, an oath over there and it's okay. But what Jesus is saying here is this. Yes, it is true. Perjury, breaking your vow or testifying falsely in a court is sin. But if you think that's all this commandment is talking about, then you've missed the bigger picture. I'm telling you this truth. It's about, this whole thing is about telling the truth, not just in the court of law, but at all times. I think I mentioned this in Sunday school when we were talking about the 10th commandment. We'll get to this next week, but you know, you shall not covet your neighbor's, and it lists a whole list of things, your wife, his house, and all these things, his ox. And I remember I knew a Christian who would say, Well, you know, the commandment actually says you shall not covet those things that belong to your neighbor, but coveting in and of itself is not sin. How did you get there? Like, that's just crazy, right? And so this is what the Pharisees were doing with this commandment. They're saying, well, you know, breaking this vow in the court of law, that's sin. But, you know, breaking your word out there, if you swear by the hairs of your head, that's not sin. Or if you swear by Jerusalem, you know, that's not sin out there. So here in Matthew 5, Jesus is basically saying three things. First of all, he's establishing the letter of the law. The letter of the law says you must fulfill your vows to the Lord, but be careful. Swearing by God's name ought to be seldom and solemn. Seldom and solemn. If you ever say, so help me God, or, you know, I swear to God, you better be careful. And you better mean it. So if you're going to swear by God's name, let it be seldom and solemn. Second, Jesus is saying, don't swear or take an oath by anything in creation, thinking there's a distinction between that and swearing to God. Because God owns everything. For example, you know, maybe sometimes people hear you say, I swear on my mother's grave. I don't think I've heard that. Actually, I see that in movies. But, you know, or I swear by my children. Well, be careful. Jesus is saying here, don't do that and think that it's a lesser oath than swearing to God, because it isn't. And then third, and probably most importantly, Jesus is saying, don't swear or take an oath in ordinary conversation at all. For God's people, for His disciples, it's unnecessary. Everything that you say ought to be truth. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. You don't need to add I swear to whatever in your conversation. Fine if you're going to do it in a court of law, if you're going to do it on a solemn occasion. But the scribes and Pharisees, they ought to know this, and so should we. Right? Proverbs again, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal faithfully are His delight. So truthfulness and speaking truth ought to mark all of God's people all of the time. Not just when we decide to take an oath or make a vow. Now, of course, when we take vows and swear under oath in a court of law, when giving testimony, or in the church, we do this, right? When you get married, you take vows. A person is ordained. When we join in membership, we take vows. We have children baptized, we take vows. When we take these vows, they ought to be with greater solemnity and seriousness. And the point that Jesus is making here is that as children of God, we're to speak the truth in love and speak truth all the time. You remember how earlier we talked about the two root causes of gossip and slander, which is, you know, pride causes us to make us want to, like, denigrate other people and raise ourselves up. Idleness may give rise for the opportunity of gossip and slander. But Jesus is saying, for my people, these things ought not to be. Integrity of speech and bearing true witness in whatever circumstance is something that God demands, if only for this simple fact. Don't miss this. We serve a God who is a God of His Word. By our words and our actions, we represent and give testimony to His faithfulness. One of the greatest assurances that you and I can have for our salvation is to recognize that God keeps the ninth commandment. You thought about that? Your whole salvation depends on the fact that God keeps His promises. The Lord is faithful to His Word. In Him there is no variation or shifting shadow, right? Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. His Word is His bond. His covenant remains true. Our only hope is that God keeps His Word. That God keeps the ninth commandment. That He's the one who keeps His promises. And here in the ninth commandment, God commands us as His servants to not bear false witness against our neighbor. But also, as Jesus peels back the layers of this law, He's teaching us what it means to bear true witness in all that we say. Because God is a God of His Word, then we, as His people, ought to strive to be as well. And that brings us to the last point this morning, which is, I think, just a wonderful example in the New Testament of a person who exemplifies what it means to be a man of integrity. Like Timothy does this. We're going to, in Philippians, Paul describes him that way. But here in Gospel of John, I want to show you something. So if you have your Bibles, turn. This is the last passage we're going to look at this morning. The Gospel according to John, chapter 1. So look at John chapter 1. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John chapter 1. And here we're going to look at near the end of the chapter. Jesus is in the midst of gathering and calling his first disciples. And look at John 1 beginning in verse 43. John 1 verse 43. The next day he, that's Jesus, purposed to go into Galilee, and he found Philip. And Jesus said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida in the city of Andrew, and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him, and he said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." By now, some of you are wondering if I'm ever going to explain the sermon title and what that's about. The title of our sermon today is WYSIWYG. It's pronounced WYSIWYG, in case you've never heard that word, WYSIWYG. The first time I heard that word, WYSIWYG, was about 18 years ago during the mayoral campaign election in Macon, Georgia. I'm not sure if it was the candidate's official campaign slogan, but when the man who eventually went on to become mayor was campaigning, he would say, "I want people to know that I am a WYSIWYG kind of guy. What you see is what you get. What you see is what you get." I went and checked back this past week. I looked him up. Robert Reichert, who served as mayor of that city, and then when the county and city joined together, he served terms from 2007 to 2020 as mayor of Macon. So I guess he did something right. And seemed to be actually a man of his word. What you see is what you get. But notice, that's Nathanael. Nathanael is a WYSIWYG kind of guy. What you see is what you get. You notice how Jesus refers to him when he first meets him. He says, "Behold an Israelite, indeed, in whom there is no deceit." I love that King James says, "Behold an Israelite in whom there is no guile." Guile is not a word that we use too often. A person in whom there is guile is a deceitful person. It's a person who is duplicitous, a schemer, a trickster. You think about like Jacob before he came to faith, before God, right? Before God changed him, before he wrestled with the man, right? Jacob was the trickster, one who grasped at the heel, a person who always has an ulterior motive for what they do or say. A guileful person has mastered the art of nuance, of using smoke and mirrors to hide behind. They're insincere and manipulative in all that they say. And everything that they say is calculated to bring about some end that they want, that they're after. That's a person who is full of guile. And some of you are thinking of people right now, or maybe you think, "I do that," right? But that's not Nathanael. Jesus says of Nathanael, "Behold, an Israelite in whom there is none of that." He is guileless. I imagine Nathanael probably would have been a pretty good friend to have, whether you liked what he said or not. Nathanael will never leave you guessing about what he thought, right? You got to love the interaction here. Having been called by Jesus, Philip goes to his friend and he says, "Nathanael, he's finally come, the Messiah, the King of Israel. He's here as Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael says what probably everyone else is thinking: "Can anything good come out of this podunk town of Nazareth?" Right? That's his response. And Philip simply says, "Come and see." Then after just this brief interaction with Jesus, where he provides this sneak peek into his omniscience and maybe even his omnipresence, because he says, right, what does he say? "How do I know you? Before Philip called you, I saw you sitting under that fig tree." Nathanael does a complete out-bowed face. "Rabbi, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel." Now, by the way, don't miss this, because this is important context also for what Jesus says of Nathanael, when he says that Nathanael is a true Israelite in whom there is no deceit, no guile, he's guileless, he is saying more than just, here comes an honest man. Here comes a man who's going to tell you what he thinks, whether you like it or not. He's saying that, but Jesus is saying actually much more. He's saying, here comes a true Israelite of faith, who when he comes to learn who I am, he's going to believe in me. Now, you may be thinking, how do you know that? What makes Nathanael a true Israelite here, though, is that he's no guile. What makes Nathanael a WYSIWYG kind of guy is not just that he says what's on his mind. It's more than that. What makes Nathanael a WYSIWYG kind of guy and a true Israelite in Jesus' eyes is that he believes and professes the right things about Jesus. Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And the reason we know this is because when Jesus makes this statement about Nathanael having no deceit in him, he's quoting Psalm 32. It was our call to worship this morning. And the context is this. It's also going to be our benediction at the end of the service too. But the context is this. How blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. That's the passage that Jesus is quoting. He calls us to be like Nathanael. A man or a woman, boy or girl, in whom there is no deceit. A person whose transgressions have been forgiven. A person whose sin is covered because we are a people boldly confessing with our words and our actions that Jesus is the Son of God, that Jesus is my King. Let's pray.